The last final presentation, The Stigma of Masculinity, Relationship Narratives of Women Partnered with African-American Behaviorally Bisexual Men, is from a dear colleague, Sonia McKenzie, who's research faculty in the Health Equity Institute and Center for Research in Education on Gender and Sexuality at San Francisco State University. This must be now the 20th panel or presentation that we've been on over the years at APHA, and I just love seeing how her work continues to flourish. So I'll turn it over to you. Great.
Thank you, Brian. Good afternoon, everybody. So this has been an excellent panel, and to switch things up a little bit, I'm going to talk about women. I'm going to talk about my research over the past year with women who are in relationships with behaviorally bisexual African-American men in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I want to thank my research team, Craig Hutchinson, Darrell Brooks, Chelsea Leonard, Lizette Smith, who have been with me over the past year, no disclosures. Okay. I want to start with a thought by sociologist Josh Gamson, actually taken from an article in a current issue of Contemporary Sociology, where he comes to a conclusion important for my talk today, and I think that we would all probably here in this room agree that there is and has been in sociology and in the social sciences more broadly a dearth of research and academic discourse around bisexuality and bisexuals. And here, as he says, the specific ways in which they're socially regulated and the theoretical challenges that they carry. So I would also add that this dearth of literature extends into public health and specifically also, and very importantly, also extends to our considerations of intersections of sexuality with health and well-being. The exception to this is always these panels, Brian, that you convene at this meeting, so it's really fantastic to be part of this. The first point that I want to emphasize today is that when bisexuality is a focus of social science, it is primarily considered as an attribute of individuals and not a socially, politically, and structurally meaningful category of analysis. And so we see this here in this conclusion of a recent article in the Huffington Post in kind of the gay Times or gay page, whatever it is, in Huffington Post, that where this author, and apologies if the author is in the room or possibly you know this author, who actually writes extensively on bisexuality, with all due respect, the author concludes, when it comes to love, it's about the individual. And here, in part, she's referring to her preference, the choices that she makes, essentially. But importantly for my talk today is really the focus on individuals, individual choice, and the ways in which this becomes really imbued within our understandings in popular discourse, in public health as well, around bisexuality. In terms of public health research, how does the designation of the behaviorally based term, MSM, or men who have sex with men, reflect both possibilities for inclusion as well as for further marginalizing bisexuals by categorizing them together with men who have exclusively had sex with men? This is not a new reflection per se. But I'm also interested in how does this term reinscribe a focus on individual behaviors as a behavioral designation rather than the social and structural contours of sexuality. And that second piece is what I want to focus on today, and I think where we really need to be focusing our work on bisexuals, bisexuality, and also as we consider those other actors in these bisexual configurations of behaviorally bisexual men, the women. So I argue that this discourse of choice and bisexuality's marginalization socially and also academically, in effect, serves to overlook the important social and structural dimensions of bisexuality. And we have not examined, in particular, the specific ways in which social class, race, and gender operate as part of daily lived experiences of bisexual lives that are not always named, yet still lived and loved. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip over the other point I was just going to make. So with regard to HIV, because I know we're almost there, we're almost at the end of the session. With regard to HIV, as I'm sure you're also very aware, a specific kind of individual focus has emerged around bisexuals that constructs men as vectors and women as victims. I discussed this in one of the chapters of my recently published book, Structural Intimacy, Sexual Stories in the Black AIDS Epidemic, but in particular around the construction of the bisexual bridge theory, quote-unquote, and also the quote-unquote DL in public health, which of course we've seen, you know, kind of the subsequent literature refuting this, but there's still very, very powerful remnants and threads of this kind of narrative. Okay, that promotes this individually based framework for trying to understand egregious and disproportionate rates of HIV specifically among African Americans. This narrative has vilified, in particular, African American men, and also at the same time, and this is also what we tend to just sort of overlook and not really pay as much attention to, in so doing it creates narratives of victimhood among women who are partnered with bisexual men. Despite, or perhaps because of this construct, there remains a sexual silence about women partnered with behaviorally bisexual men. So in my last research project, which I talked about, I think, for the last couple of years at APHA, the Maasai Project, we did interviews with 60 behaviorally bisexual African-American men in the Bay Area, in Oakland, in San Francisco. And we heard a lot in these interviews, in particular about men reflecting on the women in their lives, which led us to the question, as we analyzed the data, what would women say about their own lives, right? So this led to my current research project, which is a five-year NIMH study, which a mixed methods project examining the cultural and relationship context of HIV among behaviorally bisexual African-American men and their female partners in the San Francisco Bay Area. So over the past year, we've conducted 20 in-depth qualitative interviews with women partnered. So inclusion criteria was that they either had to report currently being in a relationship or in the last 12 months being in a relationship with a male partner who they either knew, well, basically, you know, who they believed to be bisexually active. So there was sort of a range of relationships, and I can get into that more specifically. We interviewed 11 HIV-positive women, 9 negative women, 19 women were African-American, 1 was white. And we had some younger women, 22-year-olds up to 55-year-olds. The mean age for our negative women was about 10 years younger, sort of mid-30s. Recruitment, we were pretty targeted in our recruitment. We did venue-based recruitment primarily. We did some recruiting online, actually. We provided $40 in compensation. We did a kind of a team-based approach to data analysis, and really analysis focused on these theme areas that emerged around sexual identity, relationships, sexual practices, disclosure, and kind of what I understand as in some ways the reciprocal of that, what I call knowing, so how women describe how they come to know or understand their male partner's sexuality, and also reflect on their own sexuality, and then also prevention strategies. Briefly, here's just sort of an overview of the sample in terms of SES. Most of our sample were not working. About half of our sample, or over half, had some college or college education. Okay, so we see this sort of disparity between education and work among both positive and negative participants. So we found that the daily interactions and negotiations that women described in their relationships were conditioned by characteristics at 3 levels. These are all obviously interrelated, but I find it helpful to sort of disentangle, to look at the individual or interpersonal level, culture, and structural and institutional levels. So I'm going to move forward considering 3 findings that we found kind of at each of these levels. So at the individual or kind of interpersonal level, I want to talk a bit about relationship diversity. Women described very complex relationship configurations. They described themselves as being friends, as friends with benefits, just talking, in monogamous relationships, open relationships, you name it. There were multiple forms of relationships that women were in. And importantly, about a quarter of the sample had other sexual relationships that they were not disclosing to the partners about whom they were specifically talking about in the interviews. And oftentimes this would sort of come up over, 20 minutes into the interview. Oh yeah, and then, let's talk about this. About a quarter of the positive women did not disclose their HIV status to their bisexual partners. And a third of the women identified themselves as bisexual. Oftentimes that came up, again, sort of later as the interview unfolded. So I want to talk here about one woman who was not named Annie. Annie was a 50-year-old HIV-positive woman who I interviewed. She's an ex-bar manager. She did really well working at a bar for many, many years. She has two friends with benefits, as she describes them. One partner who is in his 20s, who's bisexual and hangs out at the local gay bar. And then she's been in a 13-year relationship with a guy who's also 50. Neither of these partners know about the other, and her younger partner, who is the partner who she actually is sexually active with, does not know that she is HIV positive. And so she talks a little bit here, and I put up these quotes to sort of designate what these two relationships do for her. So she has her guy who, her 13-year relationship, they hang out at home, they watch television. She basically describes it as really boring, but really kind of essential for her daily life, right? This other guy wines and dines her, they go out, they go, they party, they have a great time, and she has sex with him. And so here she says, he'd bore me to tears, that's why I have two. I can check in and check out, sort of how she talked about these relationships. And then we talked about it, I said, when it became clear that they didn't know about each other, they don't know about each other, they don't need to know, no. Very emphatic about that. So in discussions of masculinity and stigma often surfaced in the interviews, as women discussed navigating cultural norms and expectations and their rationale also for why some bisexual men do not disclose. So women wanted men to be quote unquote man enough, while also practically in the very next statement pointing to the stigma, quote unquote, of masculinity. So here we continue with some reflections of Annie, who at one point says, if she has something that she wants to tell men, what would her message be? Be man enough. Are you man enough? She's really emphatic about this man enough statement that she has. And then she just says, just be honest. Just let your woman know, I'm bisexual, I like men. We can just go on, we don't really have to, tell anyone about this, about what happens with us. I asked, why did you think that he, in particular, the partner who she believes infected her, didn't do that? She says it's the stigma of masculinity. And then she continues to say, I want it to be like where it's no stigma. So here we see this tension, this gendered tension that women are navigating. And we heard, interestingly, in the Maasai Project, from men, a lot of what we heard from men was this stigma of masculinity. And to hear it from women in particular was particularly powerful, because these are the actors in these relationships who have been, kind of furthered as victims in these relationships and these popular discourses. Here we hear from Marissa, or not Marissa, who's 48-year-old HIV-positive woman. There's a lot of discussion of violence throughout these interviews. What I want to note in particular for this set of interviews were the ways in which women directly link their experiences of ongoing abuse and violence to their partners' sexual relationships with men. And there was a way in which they talked about, quote-unquote, shouldering it. No matter what happened, the silences, the confrontations, no matter what happened, women said that they, quote-unquote, shouldered it. So here's another woman who I interviewed. talking about one of her male partners, and they were, everything was out in the open. There had been a big series of confrontations, but they just kind of continued on with these relationships happening in their lives. Meanwhile, she got married to a woman. And she was mulling over in the interview how she was going to have to go get a divorce from the woman, because she's, anyway, so complicated relationships are happening on the part of everyone. I think that's the point I want to make here. But she talks here about this awful, awful abuse, and she points to her eyes. She's still impaired, has impaired vision in one of her eyes because he knocked out her eye socket in a fight. It's no wonder he didn't kill me. The part that bothered me back then was the fact that I had to get these ass whippings after you leave your lover, okay? So she came back to this time and time again. He would go off and be with his male lover for a few days, come back, and just take it out on her. And I asked her more questions about that, and she said it was, he wanted an impossible relationship. It took a toll on his manhood, really. So I want to bring us here to more of the kind of structural level, institutional and contextual points that we heard in the interview. In particular around housing, the relationships between, and the fact that housing stability was affected by relationships in so many of our women's lives. And this woman, Shauna, whom I also interviewed, 46, HIV negative, very, very high functioning social worker who's been an addict all of her life, very highly functioning. She was currently in drug treatment at the time of the interview, with a lot of concern that her current bisexual partner, who's her fiancé, and she's completely in love with this guy, may be HIV positive because of his ongoing sex with men while high in particular. She kind of raises something that we heard from quite a few women about, and in particular negative women, about how do I stay negative? And for Shauna in particular, who was someone who had spent the better part of, you know, the last 10 years or so high herself, all of a sudden she's in a treatment program, and at this point she's really grappling with, how do I stay negative? How am I going to do this? And she says here, well, he'd be offended where he'd probably want to kill to defend his manhood. When we're asking, I was asking, you know, are you going to talk to him? What's going to happen, basically? And again, we see this masculinity thread. You know, it'd be out of line and unacceptable, so I just don't say anything. And most of our women said, talked about kind of the impossibility of communication. And then she's sitting in the interview, and she kind of unfolds her pocket, and she has just condoms falling out of her pocket, okay? So she's just been given a bunch of condoms by an outreach worker, and she says, look, I have these, but I just can't use them. I can't do it, okay? Because of this, if I confront him, these are the repercussions. So then she brings up her strategy, which is sort of what I call the negative interruption. She says, well, like the night I got out of jail, we didn't have sex because at his mom's house, it's crowded and he's sleeping on the couch. There were a lot of interruptions, so I'm hoping for the interruptions. So she was anticipating one night, the first night that she could see him in 6 months, and basically hoping that actually they could configure a non-visit, that they wouldn't see each other, so she actually didn't have to put herself potentially at risk for HIV. So in closing, I mean, I think that so much of this really moves us to, you know, broadening our understandings and considerations of sexuality to ensure that we include bisexual formations that are not necessarily named as such. So all of these women identified themselves as heterosexual. All of their male partners, to our knowledge, would self-identify for the most part as heterosexual. So none of these understandings of behaviorally bisexual relationships would have been gathered if we put out a call for relationships on bisexuality at all, so that we know that. So if we consider the regulation of gender and sexuality as a series of negotiations taking place through social, cultural, and political institutions, some of the elements that we've heard about in today's quotes, we may be better steered toward conceptions that are more akin to structural intimacies, which I define as sexual stories produced by the meeting of intimate lives and social structural patterns, and I talk about in my book. I believe we must turn our attention to the day-to-day negotiations, the spoken and unspoken contours of sexuality, the silences among men and women who are simultaneously resisting and reinscribing heteronormativity in their relationship configurations. So I'll just leave us there. Thank you. And thank you to these amazing people, the funders, the organizations. There's my info.